Occult Confessions is brought to you commercial-free through the generous support of our patrons. Visit occultconfessions.com and click on donate to help keep the history of the occult on the digital airwaves. Joseph Smith and the Mormons were driven further and further into the western frontier, beginning with their move to Kirtland, Ohio, as their neighbors rose up against them again and again. At the John Johnson farm in Hiram, Ohio, Smith and Sidney Rigdon, a member of the early Mormon high priesthood, were tarred and feathered, driving Rigdon temporarily insane. The Mormons then relocated to far west Missouri, but their residency there terminated with the 1838 Missouri-Mormon War. The war was a series of military actions between Mormon militiamen and mobs of Missourians from a collection of northwestern towns, with both sides taking turns at committing acts of vigilante violence and the balance of vengeance tipping against the Mormons. Worry over the Mormons operating as an economic and political bloc and thereby overpowering non-Mormons led to the violence, which in turn led the Missouri governor, Lilburn Boggs, no fan of the Mormons to begin with, to expel them from the state. During the fighting, Joseph Smith, along with 60 others, including Rigdon, was captured, tried by court-martial, and ordered to be executed by firing squad. But General Alexander Doniphan refused to carry out the order, and the Mormons and their prophet were transferred to a civil court. During a prison transfer, Smith and the others escaped, either because they bribed the guards or because Boggs had determined their continued incarceration was a political liability. They next landed at Nauvoo, Illinois, which would be as far as Joseph Smith would travel on his road to the American Zion. Like Moses and the Israelites, Smith was destined to never see the Promised Land. My name is Dr. Rob C. Thompson. I am the Supreme Hierophant and your host for today's proceedings, part three of our conversation about the Mormons' last days of the prophet. Now, maybe it'll surprise you, maybe it won't surprise you that I chose Bree Littoral to do today's episode.
Hello, everybody.
Yeah, now today will, of course, Bree's our metallurgic prophet, and there will be some metal things today, but over the last 7 years, Bree, I have come to associate you with a kind of justice, I guess. You've become, like, very justice-y.
Thank you, I think
the intersection of law and religion, yeah? Mm-hmm. This is like a theme.
It's one of the things that I do a lot of research on, especially with the true crime that I like to look into and knowledge, make myself knowledgeable of.
And I think politics law is big issue in Nauvoo. There may be some psychology as well, because we're I think you're going to have an interesting take on how it is Smith persuaded so many people to engage in plural marriage, because it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
But it does happen, and exclusively, really, in Nauvoo. Yes, it'll happen in Utah, but in Smith's career, it only happens in Nauvoo. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think you're going to have an interesting take on this.
I already have a lot of opinions about modern-day Mormonism, so...
Oh, yeah, right, that's right. It's coming
so
soon.
Coming soon.
All right, let's pledge it out.
We, the members of the secret order of alchemical actors, do solemnly commit ourselves to a full and honest telling of the history of the occult as far as we know it.
Now, on that subject, off the cuff here before we get into the episode proper, Bree has been doing our Poison Roots series, which is exclusive to our patrons, but is at any dollar amount, you can hear Bree talk about unpleasant things, but it's psychology and religion. I think it's a really interesting conversation.
Yes, yeah.
Criminal psychology
and religion, but it is a lot about how psychology and religion play a part in the manipulation of people, really.
Yeah,
from other people, and there are like one-off cases and stuff, but with the current series I'm doing, which is cult related. It's one individual who just manages to do this to so many, and it's insane. And people do it in one-off situations, and it's the same with the justice system, which you'll learn in the inverse of what I'm talking about this season, next season.
There you go.
So
tune in, patrons. It's only $2 a month. to join the Patreon, but you know, you can donate up to $9 and we'd be very grateful. You would also get access to the occult classes I am now giving. Now, that doesn't mean I'm teaching you how to do magic spells and stuff, but it's a history and culture of occultism course that I've started to run through the Patreon. And let me make one plug just for my sex positive feminism episode on Strange Ride. I use a 1982 movie starring Phoebe Cates to discuss issues of sex positive feminism and the politics of sex positive feminism. So if you're not listening to Strange Ride, or if you're, you know, really jonesing because I only publish every other week here on OC, head over to Strange Ride and listen to us chat some more, but, you know, about other things. All right, let's get into this. Throughout 1838 and 1839, Mormons gathered in Commerce, renamed Nauvoo, in the state of Illinois. Illinois sold itself to the Mormons and the American public at large as a kind of kinder, gentler, and more civilized place to live than Missouri. Come to Illinois. We're not Missouri.
Nope.
A land speculator named Isaac Galland offered Mormons property on the Illinois and Iowa sides of the Mississippi River, and Robert Lucas, governor of the Iowa Territory, promised them religious liberty and protection from federal persecution. Smith had been interested in Galland's land, and after his escape from the, you know, Missouri militia, arranged for a large purchase while in Quincy. The land had been owned by Native Americans, but was then gifted by the federal government to veterans of the War of 1812, like, you know, the federal government does. But those veterans were uninterested in settling the land, and most sold their tracts to speculators.
So what's the point, federal government?
Took it from the Indians. Gave it to guys who didn't even want it. What a federal government move. Mid-19th century federal government move. Anyhow, for a brief stretch after 1820, the land was a trading spot along the water, but an economic panic ended that and left speculators, land speculators, that is, with a whole lot of territory to unload. That's when the Mormons arrived and presented a new opportunity. They bought 700 acres for $136,500.
You're joking.
No,
that's insane.
It's like a third the cost of a house.
Yeah.
I mean, like a regular middle-class house these days. To remain on good terms with Illinois politicians, church leaders took the advice of one Robert Thompson, for real, yeah, yeah, and decided not to align themselves with any political party. So I was preaching centrist politics even back then. The threat of Mormons, Vampire Rob,
yeah, honestly,
advising cults since 1839. The threat of Mormons voting as a bloc had in part brought them to grief in Missouri. So what that means is this was a fear of the Catholics as well, that the entire Mormon organization would vote for the same party, which gives them inordinate amounts of power politically if they all make the same choice.
It's really interesting if you look at Utah now.
Right.
But that's for me to talk about in a different podcast.
Anyhow, Mormons petitioned the government for restitution, and journalists and politicians, including a young Abraham Lincoln, spoke out against vigilante mob justice and was practiced against the Mormons. So Lincoln wasn't like way pro-Mormon, but he was anti-vigilante justice. The West could not function as an American state or as a collection of American states if it did not abide by the rule of law. This was more or less Lincoln's perspective. A group of Mormons traveled with Smith to Washington, D.C. to meet the members of Congress and the president, but then-President Martin Van Buren refused to help the Mormons, fearing retribution from the state of Missouri, which was still pretty miffed about the whole Mormon thing. He said the actions of state-sponsored militia were not the business of the federal government. Smith resolved to turn the Mormons against Van Buren, reviving their power and potential threat as a political bloc. Not a great idea.
Not helping himself.
Stephen A. Douglas, best known today for his presidential run against Abraham Lincoln and defeating Lincoln, actually, in his run for Senate, actively courted the Mormons as political allies. Douglas was a proponent of Nauvoo's city charter and actually visited the Mormons in Nauvoo, attempting to right Smith's attitude toward the Democrats, which had been soured by Van Buren, who, by the way, was a Democrat. I want to say, if for those of you who are not hip to it, like the words Democrat, Republican mean nothing in the 19th century compared to what we understand.
It's completely different.
Completely different.
Yeah.
When the Mormons helped to elect the Democratic candidate for governor, Adam Snyder, the Whig candidate press, or the Whig press, I should say, denounced them. So the Whigs were yet another political party in the 19th century, because we had several, not just the two. They pressed for denouncing the Mormons for voting together at the direction of their prophet. In fact, every candidate supported by the Mormons in the sparsely populated and closely divided state won. So the fear of Mormon political power is real.
Yeah.
As had happened in Missouri, the Mormons' failure to separate church and state struck a sour chord with their neighbors in Illinois. The Mormons got back to their military aspirations as well. Now, this is not going to be so great either. So, right, imagine, it's Illinois.
We're in Illinois.
Right. You are not a Mormon. You're just a guy.
Right.
And a guy and a girl, you and me, hanging out in Illinois. Just a couple of people in Illinois.
Having a coffee.
And we just heard that the entire state election seems to have been swayed by the Mormons.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, this guy rides by on a horse shouting like Paul Revere. And he's like, the Mormons are making a militia.
I wouldn't be happy.
No, we'd be a little terrified.
Yeah.
We would throw down our coffee and move to Iowa.
Yeah.
It's the only reason we would move to Iowa.
The only. Literally the only reason.
All my love to any Iowa listeners we might have. Somehow I doubt your existence, but you'll write in, right? If you're out there.
Oh, they will.
Let me know. Smith organized a 600-member Nauvoo Legion. 600.
That's not a militia, Rob. That's a whole, like, unit. Like, that's a whole part of an army. It's a whole army.
Right, yeah. Like, you could go ahead and put Stonewall Jackson in charge of those guys, right? Like,
oh my God.
That's a big deal. Smith had reason to want such a militia for protection. In September 1840, Missouri's governor, Boggs, was on his way out of office and issued an order for Smith to be extradited back to Missouri to stand trial for treason.
So he said, I got crimes. I don't want to be extradited. Let me just build a 600-man army to protect me.
What? Yeah. I mean, I will say I'm not convinced that Missouri had a case against him.
No.
However, this is a pretty extreme.
That's such an extreme response. Like, imagine if there was somebody... Like, imagine if Jim Jones didn't go the way that he did, and that's what he did. He just made an army instead, and his would have been, like... almost twice the size.
It was a different time, Brie.
It's a different time.
You made an army back then, is what you did.
I suppose.
You didn't move to, what was it, South America?
Yeah.
Ghana. You made an army.
Yep.
So Smith told his believers that an apocalypse was coming.
Of course.
And so God's elect had to gather together in anticipation of those end times. The apostles, or Quorum of 12, were leading efforts to convert new members and send them back to Nauvoo. Brigham Young was in London, where the Industrial Revolution had so disrupted the economy that many of the British were poor and indigent. The middle class evaporated in London and, you know, England writ large, as machines made farming less labor-intensive and rural farmers than had, you know, not out of work, flooded the cities, where they worked long, grueling hours in factories for little pay. Think Charles Dickens, right?
Right.
Any Charles Dickens.
Yeah.
Young and his fellow apostles wandered from church to church preaching the Mormon message, which was often well received. Because you're poor and your life sucks. And these guys are like, we got a prophet back in America. And as they won converts, eager to leave the squalor of the metropolitan slums, they made arrangements with passenger ships to move the British west to America and up to Nauvoo. It's amazing. It's quite a system.
How efficient they are.
Yeah, they're good.
So efficient.
They are good. I will say in their defense that you are going to be living a better life.
That's true.
After you leave London. Your material conditions will be improved. But the Mormonism feels optional.
Right. I feel like that shouldn't be a stickler for, like, that shouldn't be a reason that I can have a better life. I should be able to have the better life without forced Mormonism.
For some reason, it doesn't cross their minds. Maybe it does. Like, maybe some guys cross the ocean, they get to New York, and like, okay, I'm done. That's as far as I go. But
I guess.
A lot of them do make it to Illinois, and then ultimately Utah. By the time the Mormons settled in Utah, more than 50,000 of Queen Victoria's subjects would leave the motherland and gather in America's Zion. 50,000.
That's so many people.
Yeah, go Brigham, go.
Oh my God.
He didn't do all that, but, you know, he was part of that first mission.
Yeah.
In the summer of 1840, Smith received a letter from John C. Bennett, then quartermaster of the Illinois militia, presumably unknown to the state militia. Bennett had been a roving grifter, working as a doctor, a minister, college administrator, and then was ejected from a Masonic lodge in Ohio 6 years before, and he left his wife and child behind after that event.
So he was just working as those things. I don't imagine he had the qualifications to be any of those things.
No,
at least not
no.
all of them.
Certainly not a
doctor.
A doctor. Maybe a college administrator.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't know.
Obviously none of my college administrators listen to the show. Again, write in if you're from Iowa and a college administrator. So...
you're not...
Ooh, no cruising today. Smith... trying to piss Iowa off, trying to piss off my own bosses. Smith, ignorant of Bennett's checkered past, welcomed him into the city, and he was elected mayor of Nauvoo.
No.
Yes. Grifter in chief.
Okay.
But Smith didn't know, right? In April 1840, sure. In April 1841, with Sidney Rigdon Ailing, who was like Smith's go-to
right,
guy.
Right, right.
Bennett rose to become assistant president of the church, so now he's not only a secular but a religious authority. Meanwhile, rumors had started to circulate that Bennett had tried to seduce a young woman. Smith sent a confidant, George Miller, across the country to Pittsburgh to research Bennett's background, and Miller returned with the troubling news that Bennett was, in fact, very bad news.
If he had the ability to do some checks and balances in the first place...
Yeah.
Should
have sent the guy out on day one before we let him be mayor.
Right.
Smith confronted Bennett, who confessed, and then attempted suicide by overdose.
That escalated, okay.
Yeah. But he was rescued by doctors, and Smith accepted his promises to become a better man while reducing his role in church affairs.
Okay.
To forgive is divine, Bree.
Is it, though? Is it?
I mean, authority is another thing, in my opinion. I think it is fine to forgive, but
right.
to a certain extent, like, you know... all these guys who get up to bad deeds, I would rather forgive and remove.
That's the thing, is the removal is the follow-up yes. to the forgiveness.
Right, but we did not remove.
No.
Bennett's still kicking around. I mean, we did. We knocked him down in the church, but not, I think, in the rest of his role in
Nauvoo. Is he still
the
mayor?
I believe
like,
so, yeah.
That, I feel like that's the more important part of this equation.
Work on Nauvoo, but he's so charismatic. Work on Nauvoo's temple got underway as Smith began to experiment with new aspects of the Mormon faith. So, all of the funkiest Mormon ideas, I think, come from here. If you don't think the Book of Mormon is funky, this is when Mormonism starts to get funky, independent of the Book of Mormon. So,
I see.
This is one of my favorite Mormon practices, and by favorite, I mean it creeps me out. But since the dead had no way of converting to the true faith of Mormonism, Smith developed a proxy form of baptism wherein a living relative stood in for the deceased and was baptized in their name into the faith. Most infamously, they did this to Anne Frank very recently. Yeah. I mean, you can't do that to a relative, so I guess the ceremony must have changed. But like, if you were like, you know, I've told you all these Mormon truths, right? And now you're going to get to go to good Mormon heaven. And but then like your dad, you know, your mom, your grandparents, you know, you got a bunch of children even maybe who are dead.
Right.
So you come over to me and you're like, what do I do about all these guys? They're in like Mormon hell. And I'm like, no, don't worry about it. We'll just baptize them through you so they can all be in Mormon heaven with you.
But what if I'm dead and I don't want to be in Mormon heaven?
Oh, too bad. You're going. Yeah, you're having a good time, right? You're in Valhalla or something, and suddenly you blink out of Valhalla.
I don't want that.
And you're in Mormon
don't take
heaven,
me,
enjoying decaffeinated beverages.
Oh my God!
What happened?
No,
I was getting drunk with the Vikings, and now I'm hanging out with these decaffeinated guys.
Oh, I cannot imagine. Oh my God!
Also on April 5th.
Never been so stressed out about something that couldn't possibly happen to me.
Well, you would think. That's what Anne Frank thought. On the 5th of April, Smith married Louisa Beeman, his sister-in-law and his first plural wife. So this is weird doctor number two.
Yeah.
They were married in secret, and the story was only ever told by the man who performed the ceremony, namely Joseph Noble, 30 years after the event. But... so that's how secret it was. 30 years later is the first time we heard about this wedding.
Was that well kept? That's
insane.
Yeah,
because it was just the one guy who knew and the girl.
And they just never...
They never spoke of it.
Okay.
Well, maybe I'll answer it later. Yeah, maybe. Who knows? Maybe events will help to answer whatever question is kicking around in there. There isn't a great reason to doubt Noble's story, since Smith developed a well-documented and observed obsession with spiritual wifery and plural marriage for the rest of his life. So we could say, oh, well, he just made that story up. But it's a bizarre thing to make up.
It's very strange.
He married roughly 30 women, Joseph Smith, and led another 100 human beings into the practice of plural marriage.
I think my confusion is because I am so used to anytime plural marriage gets brought up in any of the stories that I talk about, there's a distinct motive for it, and secrecy eliminates that motive entirely.
How so?
Well, because the point of the plural marriage and all of the things that I see is to, one, have sex with many people, and it's a power play over those, not just the women, but the men around you, because then they have been taken from that option. And to me, it's that ownership of the person is eliminated with the secrecy. It just doesn't make sense to me.
I mean, the sex remains a possibility, although he doesn't, I don't believe he has sex with all of his wives. And there, it's this common, Brigham Young too, like many Mormons have connubial relationships and non-connubial relationships. So you could get married for reasons that involve completely asexual relations, let's say. But the power thing, yeah, is not true of Smith.
It's just strange to me. I've not seen that.
Because everybody gets to. Like, he inducts many men into the practice. He's not the only one who's getting to do it, you know?
It's just weird. It's so weird.
And he's trying to hide it from a lot of people, especially at the beginning. So, the sisters Zena and Presendia Huntington were next to wed Smith. Sisters.
Those names.
Yes,
sorry.
Isn't that cool?
Zena and Presendia. The same person.
Yeah.
Weird.
Well, but you can, because you're more than one. So he went right for it, right? He didn't mess around.
No, he didn't. He saw an opportunity and he took it.
With Zena and Presendia. Although in their case, this may prove your PowerPoint a little bit. They both had living husbands, Zena and Presendia.
Okay.
Then he married his dead brother's wife, Agnes Moulton Coolbrith. That makes good sense, and that's good Old Testament practice to
People
marry your dead brother's wife.
People sometimes do that modernly, though, too.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Like, that's okay.
But here you got many wives, so...
Right, that's the problem.
Your obligation is to take care of her as your brother's wife and your brother's dad.
Right.
I believe this is an Old Testament statement.
Yeah.
Most scholars suggest that Smith did not consummate, as I'm saying, all of his marriages, but historian Benjamin Parks points out there is no way to know how many of his wives he did or did not have sexual relations with. Obviously, he wouldn't be keeping a notebook. Had sex with Agnes today. It was... 4 out of 10.
I mean, there are a couple that they like to document. Yes. I wouldn't put it past anyone.
Smith is so busy spinning doctrine and stuff and church histories, I think he doesn't have time.
It seems like this marriage thing is a secondary thought to just twist into the doctrine and isolate them more.
I mean, we'll dig into it more and we'll see if that holds water for you as we go. But it's I think that's a possible way to
do
it.
It seems like it's trying to make them stand out in a very niche way that nobody else... It's not approved of. It's like trying to not be approved of.
I see what you mean.
Yeah.
They're edging, edgelording.
Yeah.
In 1842, Smith further refined the Mormon faith with his work on a handful of papyrus scrolls. You're going to love this.
Oh, boy.
Okay, so this is another weird moment. All the weird happens in Nauvoo. So if the golden plates weren't weird enough... So this is what happens. He gets his hands on some papyrus scrolls. Now, he'd purchased these along with a mummy from an antiques dealer in Ohio in 1835.
Okay, continue.
So.
I'm listening.
When antiquities excavator Antonio Lobolo died 5 years earlier, he had unearthed and more or less stole 11 mummies along with papyri in the Egyptian city of Thebes. His estate sent those to New York to be sold. Michael Chandler purchased some of these and then sort of went on tour of the United States displaying them, like, you know, Barnum style.
Right.
And was, what am I saying? So audiences paid, and Chandler was entrepreneurial and he had no attachment to these mummies. So if people got really, you know, excited about them and they had the cash, he would sell them a mummy.
Okay.
So you would pay for a ticket to see the mummy, and then you'd be like, and for an additional $100, you can take this one home with you. Which Smith wanted to.
I probably would too, to be honest with you.
Smith's Book of Mormon was purportedly written in Reformed Egyptian. And so when Chandler came to Ohio, Smith naturally took an interest and ended up buying some of the display. Smith created a grammar and alphabet based on the text that he used to translate the Book of Abraham, which told the story of the ancient patriarch's travels to Canaan and Egypt and a vision that Abraham had. In the book, Smith detailed some new and unusual doctrines. First, that the priesthood was something earned in a previous life. Ooh.
Okay.
Yeah, we got reincarnation now.
I do like that.
Second, that God lives near the star Kolob at the pinnacle of the universe.
That's really specific for me.
Kolob. Love it. Kolob. Okay. Third, that humans exist as spirits before coming to Earth, where they begin their preparation to meet God. I love this idea, too.
I do get that, because it's kind of similar to the idea of, like, energy. You are energy, and you go, you release that, and then with the reincarnation thing, that energy is brought back. Again, it makes sense to me.
It's a natural question my children have, right? Where was Everett before he got here is what my daughter wants to know. He's floating around in space.
Yeah. You know?
He was a spaceman.
Spaceman.
Finally, Smith said via Abraham that a plurality of gods, mm-hmm. led by the Supreme God, had assembled the universe from pre-existing matter.
I'm curious where he picked that from, because that does get brought up in, like, the OG Norse Eddas, too.
I mean, it's very pagan.
Yeah.
God's universe was a hierarchy, and humanity resembled that hierarchy with individuals of varying intelligence occupying varying degrees of authority. In this meritocracy, I guess, okay, the smarter you are, the higher up you go. Women played a key role in the establishment of the new settlement. Dozens had lost their husbands in the fighting in Missouri, and more men had been sent off on missions to convert more Mormons and bring them to Nauvoo. So we have a lot of single ladies.
Right.
Emma Hale Smith, Joseph's wife, had saved the prophet's sacred manuscripts when he was arrested by bringing them across the icy Mississippi River sewn into her clothes.
Okay.
The Female Relief Society was established to maintain virtue and punish sin. Smith supported the women of the Relief Society in the hope that they might screen him from public scrutiny as his polygamy project unfolded.
I see. Okay.
Right. So we have these women who, you know, inherently trust him. He's not telling them anything about the polygamy, but their very existence is to defend him, more or less.
Right.
So off they're going to go. Emma Smith accused Clarissa Marvel of spreading a rumor about her husband engaging in plural marriage with the widow of his brother, Don Carlos. Smith had, in fact, married Agnes, but the Relief Society did not root this fact out. It found Marvel innocent of gossiping about the prophet and considered her case a warning to others not to speak out of turn about Joseph Smith's activities. For his part, Smith granted the women the rights of the priesthood when it had previously been reserved for men. Let me say that one more time. He granted to women the rights of the priesthood when it had previously been reserved for men.
That's pretty radical.
And I don't believe it jives with contemporary practice.
No.
While Smith was pleased with the way the women unknowingly protected his plural marriages, he was less pleased with how quickly their society grew, gaining more than 1,300 members in 2 years. So it's almost like you have this, you know, virtue police that's providing a smokescreen for you, and then it just becomes so enormous that all you can see is smoke, and you're not sure if anybody's seeing you.
Right.
As Parks points out, the more of these women there were, and the more powerful they were, the more likely they were to eventually bring the hammer down on polygamy. When Smith approached Nancy Rigdon, her father, Sidney, remember, Father Sidney was his second in command. Well, Sidney was mad. He was furious, in fact. Smith managed to calm Dad down, but not the daughter. He inducted his 12 apostles into the practice of plural marriage as young single women came streaming into the Nauvoo settlement from Britain and the eastern United States. And in 1842, the Nauvoo City Council passed a resolution that anyone caught in an adulterous relationship would spend 6 months in jail and pay a hefty fine. I'm sort of going back and forth here so you can get the feel of how this is.
Yeah, okay.
On one side, we have plural marriage expanding. On the other side, we have Smith approaching women who are rejecting him, getting upset about it, potentially becoming problems for him by outing him, and the Nauvoo City Council saying polygamy is wrong.
Right.
Yikes. Bennett's still here, by the way. Remember Mayor Bennett?
Right.
He was using Smith's example to persuade women and perhaps some men to sleep with him.
Good for him, I guess. I don't...
And he offered to perform an abortion in his capacity as a physician if conception should result.
But he's not a physician, right? Like, I feel like there's no...
He should not be performing even, like...
He shouldn't look at any... He shouldn't even do a physical exam.
No, he shouldn't be clipping nails in his capacity. No.
No.
And yet, he says, it's okay, baby. Let's have a plural marriage. I know you're worried about that society will think, but it's okay. I got them medical skills.
Okay.
Smith finally decided to eject him from Nauvoo.
Thank the gods.
But this is more about Smith thinking that he's got a crazy man in his plural marriage club.
I mean,
going to bring the house down on him.
It's true.
Yes, it is true. It's a good assessment.
Whatever the reason, get him out.
However, Bennett fled the city and began to speak out against Smith and the Mormons, claiming that they had plotted to kill him and that Smith had conspired to assassinate Governor Boggs of Missouri, among other things.
That took a turn. Okay.
Yeah. We won't hear the last of Bennett, but
I'm sure.
It'll be a couple of episodes, actually, before he returns. He doesn't ever truly go away. Well, he does eventually, but anyhow. Speaking of Governor Boggs, he's no longer governor. He was fired on with buckshot, though, in his home, which lodged in his skull, neck, and throat by an unidentified assailant who many assumed was Mormon because of Boggs' problem with the Mormons. After finding the buckshot pistol, which had been stolen from a local shopkeeper, the sheriff charged Smith's bodyguard, Orrin Porter Rockwell, with the attempted murder. Rockwell was defended by none other than Alexander Doniphan, who, if your memory is good, he's the same man who had, in his capacity as general, refused to execute Joseph Smith all the way back at the beginning at Far West.
It's crazy how things just turn full circle
yeah.
in situations like this.
The sheriff had held Rockwell for a year, but was unable to produce any evidence against him, and Rockwell was acquitted. When Rockwell was first arrested, Boggs signed an affidavit saying he could prove that Smith had ordered the hit, and the Illinois governor, who had just lost an election, signed the extradition order, but Nauvoo's council had passed an ordinance saying that their own municipal court had a right to evaluate any such request before it could be carried out in the city limits. So, you have to get Nauvoo's approval for your non-Nauvoo whatever.
Which, why would you?
They're always going to vote against you, especially when it comes to Smith. But Smith wasn't hedging his bets here, or he was hedging his bets. He went into hiding and eventually wound up in Springfield for a hearing where the court found the extradition order was based on flawed logic and overturned it. This was in Springfield, so.
Right.
Remarkably, Smith expanded his marriages still further with the addition of Eliza R. Snow, an unmarried woman who was a leading figure in the Relief Society. Here's how you get to the heart of the Relief Society.
Yep.
For Snow, while Smith's system undermined the moral and proto-feminist mission of the Relief Society, plural marriage to Smith offered stability in a society where unmarried women were often left to fend for themselves with few resources, legal or otherwise. You see? So she's thinking, like, broadly, this is bad, but personally, not so bad.
I guess.
Yeah. After the decision of the Springfield court, Smith believed he could act with impunity, but his own community was becoming increasingly conflicted about him. After Bennett's various accusations were aired and made their way back to the Nauvoo community, many high-ranking Mormons began to doubt Smith. Maybe not many. Enough.
Right.
On July the 22nd, the church passed a resolution reaffirming that Smith was a virtuous man, but Orson Pratt did not sign on. Orson had been baptized by his brother Parley Pratt back in New York and had been an elder of the church since 1830.
Wow.
He was one of the original apostles and traveled to the British Isles to convert new Mormons along with Brigham Young. Bennett had accused Smith of proposing marriage to Orson's wife, Sarah, which Sarah bitterly confirmed, although Smith denied it. Yeah, not good. Not good.
One of the rejectees.
Orson sided with his wife, and the church excommunicated the Pratts. When Bennett proposed to Rigdon and Pratt that they kidnap Smith, Bennett is okay. Intense. Yeah. Don't
all
mess
right,
with Bennett.
Bennett.
I mean, don't mess with Bennett as in don't ever bring him in because it's too late the day
no.
you let him into the house. So he's not done. Pratt brought the letter to Smith, by the way, who promptly admitted the apostle back into the fold and rebaptized him. So he kicks Pratt out. He proposes to the man's wife, kicks him out. Then when Bennett threatens his life with Pratt, Pratt says, "Oh, I'm going to tell Joe," goes back and tells him. Joseph's like, "Oh, man, we're buds again, aren't we?" And Pratt's like, "Yeah,
oh
we
my
are.
God.
We are buds, in fact." Pratt's wife, for her part, never forgave Smith and eventually divorced her husband for it.
I mean, yeah, I understand.
Yeah,
it's understandable.
Not good. Over the first half of 1843, Smith added 12 wives to his plural marriage arrangement.
I don't get the point. Like, I don't get why... I just don't get why he's pushing so hard when he knows full well the, like, rift he is creating in his own... I'm going to call it a cult because it is cult.
Scholarly-wise, yes, cult defines any religious group, right? It's odd.
He pushes so hard
for it. I think that's the key question, Bree, that I don't have the answer to. I think it's the most mysterious thing about this.
It doesn't seem like there's any clear purpose to it, because it's not for any of the conventional usual reasons that somebody like him would do it.
It seems to be a genuine religious conviction that he arrives at.
But it's like, why?
Because, I mean, from a neurotic standpoint, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong here, but 12... And they're of all ages, you know, they're from all backgrounds. 12. 30 wives, ultimately. Like that can't be a sexual drive that's informing this choice. I don't know. And there's such a risk. Like, some of these women, like Sidney Rigdon's daughter and Pratt's wife, reject him.
Right.
It's bad.
But he's still pushing and pushing.
Yes.
I just don't get it. I don't get how it could be beneficial enough to be worth the damage it causes.
In the spring, he introduced the practice to his brother Hiram for the first time. Hiram Smith had been an active supporter of efforts to root out licentiousness among the Nauvoo populace, including polygamy. But the prophet said, the practice in terms that his brother could accept. Listen up now.
Okay. I'm here. My ears are open. I'm listening.
Again, a risky move.
Right.
Very risky move. Hiram's been very anti-polygamy, but Joseph says, "I'm going to talk him into this." I think he truly is a believer. Hiram's first wife, Jerusha, had died, and he had remarried. In heaven, Hiram could expect to have two wives. And so... Brigham Young, who was in this little meeting with Hiram, explained to Hiram that the doctrine of plural marriage would make this not only permissible, but righteous. There's your logic. That's really the core spiritual logic of plural marriage.
He must genuinely believe this so much, because it's a hill he's willing to ruin everything on.
It literally will die on, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not exactly the cause, but nevertheless, it doesn't help.
No.
Yeah. So.
Okay.
Park says that it's not clear exactly when Smith revealed his other marriages to his wife, Emma, but we do know that she consented for him to be married to four young women, ranging in age from 17 to 22, who the Smith family had taken into their home. Emma likely believed these unions were purely spiritual until she discovered her husband alone with Eliza Snow behind a locked door and attempted to break in. The prophet dictated a new revelation that rooted power and authority with the Mormon husband, investing Mormon wives with the responsibility of producing seed to expand their husband's domain. Emma told Hiram the new revelation was not to be believed and threatened her husband with a divorce. He signed over 60 lots in Nauvoo to her, as well as a riverboat, promising to take no more wives that autumn, which he did, except for the one wife that he took in the autumn. It's insane. It's kind of insane.
Right? There's just so much... These people have so much audacity.
Smith is
genuine audacity.
It's insane. Like, his wife has him by the collar, right?
Yeah.
And she's like, she's got a knife to his throat, you know, metaphorically. And he's like, no, I you're right. I got it, Emma. Here's a boat, and I promise I will not do any more plural marriages. And then as soon as he gets away from her, he's like, I just one plural marriage. It's like an addiction.
I don't understand right? it.
I'm just going to do one. I'm just going to do one more. Just one. She'll
it's
never
insane.
Know. She won't care. Just one. And then I won't do any more.
It's like, that's...
This revelation was only shared with a relatively small inner circle who took up the practice of plural marriage. Let's remember, we've let Smith, Emma Smith in, we've let Hiram Smith in on the secret, but it is still a secret. The majority of Nauvoo don't know that this is a thing, although of course there are rumors that the elite of Nauvoo are up to this.
Right.
Meanwhile, Missouri wasn't finished with Joseph Smith, and the Illinois legislature was discussing whether the Nauvoo charter gave local officials too much power. Well, now, fancy that.
You don't say.
Of course. Joseph Reynolds, sheriff of Jackson County, arrived in Nauvoo with Harmon Wilson, deputy sheriff of Hancock County. This is really a fun story. Okay. Posing as missionaries, they gained access to Smith and promptly arrested him. Right, for amassing too much power, right? For a kind of treason, I guess.
Yeah.
But Smith called for legal counsel and had the sheriffs arrested by county officers for false imprisonment of him.
That's fun. Okay.
We're not done. They set out for Quincy and the circuit court to hear arguments, but the Nauvoo Legion intercepted them, the militia, and brought their prophet home. A parade concluded in a formal dinner at the Smith home, where the sheriff, Reynolds, and his assistant, Wilson, sat at the head of the table as the guests of honor. Can you imagine these guys' day?
What a whiplash of a day for them.
Nauvoo's court freed Smith with a writ of habeas corpus, and two very confused sheriffs made their way home empty-handed.
Yeah, I can't imagine being like, I gotta arrest this dude. Oh, I'm getting arrested. Oh, I'm at the head of a dinner table?
The moment they announce the arrest, it's like Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory just descends down around them. And nothing makes sense after that.
Oh.
Smith and the Mormons grew bolder. They petitioned the United States Congress to declare Nauvoo a federal territory beyond the authority of the state of Illinois until Missouri provided restitution for past injustices and Illinois promised to protect the Latter-day Saints. Smith, as mayor, would be granted the right to raise an army of federal troops to assist the Nauvoo Legion against any invading frontier mobs. Smith began to talk about a presidential run, about which he was unreasonably optimistic, while his non-Mormon neighbors and the rest of America found the idea laughable at best and offensive at worst. I think this suggests the degree to which he's entered a closed loop.
Oh, yeah. And it kind of still shows today in Utah.
Okay. That will be interesting to hear about. Mm-hmm. Mormon electioneers set out across the country to win voters rather than converts and host conventions in every state, culminating in Baltimore in July. Meanwhile, Smith started to consider relocating the Mormons yet again. Texas, anxious to add armed men, also warm, warm armed men to its ranks.
Perfect.
To defend itself against Mexico, was interested in welcoming the Mormons, of course. Like, here's a bunch of hundreds of armed dudes. Let's do this.
Okay.
John Walton, former mayor of Galveston, wrote to them that there were 265,000 acres ready for purchase in the eastern part of the territory. In 1844, Erasmus Bostwick accused Hiram Smith of having several spiritual wives and alternating who he slept with night by night. And, he said, there was a prostitution ring operating in town near the temple. He was fined $50 and Smith denounced him in front of an audience of 8,000. Emma used the Bostwick affair as an excuse to openly condemn the practice of plural marriage, though.
Good for her.
She asked William Phelps, one of Smith's ghostwriters, to write a defense of Mormon virtue, because Smith is constantly turning out as the prophet. He's constantly writing.
Right.
So he needs a guy to actually, you know, flesh it out. Say something about the Egyptians and, you know, this and this.
I have this mummy now.
Right. Yeah, talk about that. Tell the people. So Smith, Emma Smith, goes to this ghostwriter and she says, okay, I want you to denounce marital immorality for me. Write us a good thing. It explicitly condemned polygamy, bigamy, and adultery. After having the document published under her own and her secretary's names in the Nauvoo paper, she brought it to the Relief Society for a vote, where it was unanimously approved. She encouraged Mormons to follow what Joseph Smith taught from the pulpit rather than his secret private teachings that he was communicating among his inner circle. Her husband, for his part, established the kingdom, separate from the church, a new council of exclusively men who would rule under Smith in a post-apocalyptic world.
Yeah, of course he did that.
He's got a government all set up.
Oh my God.
The council, who were not to discuss their business with their wives, because you wouldn't want to do that. Not with the wives. They would have no constitution, but function as a living, breathing constitution, making the rules as they went along.
Go. Sorry. That hurts.
Right, I know. It's tough to hear this day and age.
It hurts so much.
So, I want to be clear that still nobody knows about the plural marriage. Officially nobody knows about the plural marriage stuff, the Nauvoo populace.
Right.
So Emma Smith is really playing a game with Joseph Smith. She is now actively attacking this practice and daring him to come out. Dissension continued to fester. An anti-Smith newspaper, the Nauvoo Expositor, began printing issues blocks from the Nauvoo Temple. It began to make public the practice of plural marriage as practiced by the Smiths, Brigham Young, Heber Kimball, and other top members of the Mormon hierarchy. Hiram countered by attempting to argue that the prophet was only speaking about a man's right to marry after his wife had died, the original argument that had persuaded him.
Mm-hmm.
But that was far from the truth. Hiram apparently is sleeping with multiple women himself. The prophet asked for a city ordinance to silence the press, and a mob led by the city marshal drug the expositor's printing press into the street and burned it. So,
no.
Rival newspaper speaking out against the prophet has now been burned.
Wow.
Yeah, talk about mob violence. Francis M. Higbee, an editor of the Expositor, who had been a member of the High Council before he was excommunicated, testified against Smith, and a warrant was issued for his arrest in Hancock County for inciting a riot. Fearing the situation could quickly spiral out of control, the Illinois Governor Thomas Ford visited and determined Smith was to blame. Smith fled across the river to the Iowa Territory in the middle of the night, and the council determined to burn or bury their minutes. So now the secret apocalyptic government is getting tense and excited because Smith has fled. Emma and other Mormons worried that if Smith evaded justice, the town would be burned and its inhabitants slaughtered. And so Smith surrendered to authorities. He told his family that he did not expect to outlive this crisis. His enemies, however, were not so sure, since Smith had managed to evade the legal system several times before. The Smith brothers were brought to Carthage under indictment, where the charge of treason was added for declaring martial law in Nauvoo. An organized militia, along with a mob, surrounded the jail where Joseph and Hiram wrote letters in preparation for their legal defense. Rather than wait for the courts, a mob formed, justified now by the fact that an extra-legal Mormon mob had started this series of events by breaking into the Nauvoo Expositor. I mean, not really justified, but in their heads, right? They think, well, he's going to start a mob. We can start a mob.
They have a reason now.
On the afternoon of June the 27th, Joseph and Hiram Smith sat in their jailhouse room with John Taylor and Willard Richards, along with six other men. Between 150 and 250 men had gathered outside the jailhouse. Some painted themselves with wet powder to disguise themselves. And at 5 in the evening, they stormed into the jail. The jail's guards, the Carthage Greys, fired shots into the air in an attempt to feign a defense. So they're just faking it. Upstairs, Hiram and Joseph Smith reached for pistols that had been smuggled in for them the day before. In your jail, right? Like you have in your jail.
Right, yeah.
There was a confrontation at the door. I mean, I guess it turns out they were right. They should have had the pistols. Hiram was struck on the left side of his face by a bullet and fell, dying. Taylor was hit by a hail of bullets while attempting to jump out of the window, but he ultimately survived.
Crazy, okay.
Yeah. The prophet fired several rounds into the mob and made for the window himself. By then, they had forced open the door and shot past Richards, who also survived, and at Joseph Smith. So two men survived this, and the Smith brothers, the prophet, was shot twice in the back, once in the breast, fell through the second-story window to the ground. Outside, several men dragged him to a nearby well and shot him at least four more times to assure that he was dead. Shouting, "The Mormons are coming," the mob quickly dispersed, but no Mormon force arrived. Samuel Harrison Smith, Joseph and Hiram's younger brother, was the first on the scene and accompanied the bodies back to Nauvoo. Samuel was possibly attacked by a mob en route, and he died 30 days later. Five men were tried for the assassination in front of a jury of non-Mormons, and every one of them was acquitted.
I'm not surprised. I mean, it sucks. It's like, I don't condone the murder of anybody.
Right, right.
But
this is no way to get your justice.
No. And you're just gonna you're just gonna fuel the future fire that you've created here.
And I think we can certainly blame him to a large extent for what happened with the printing press, but you don't get shot for that.
No, you don't.
Clearly the Mormons had not arrived at their promised Zion and Nauvoo, but it would be up to another man to bring them home. Final thoughts on Joseph Smith and his last days.
I do. I just don't have... I'm trying to think of the way that I want to form these thoughts into words.
I think that this is often a misunderstood story.
Oh, well, I definitely agree, yeah.
I mean, the spreading of the polygamy and all, I think there's just this idea that Joseph Smith just wandered around telling everybody to have as many wives as possible.
And he didn't.
But he did not. It was very secretive.
He tried so hard to both push for it and to hide it. I think because a part of him obviously knew, like, it wasn't gonna work.
Right.
Not for him. It's not going to work there, you know.
I think there's also a misconception that some of the Mormon weirdnesses were there from the beginning, but I think their most infamous weirdnesses really do come from
Nauvoo.
They're
right here, yeah.
Even weirdnesses that, you know, we'd never heard before, like the many gods theory.
Right, right.
Yeah.
It seems definitely like the outlier, the outcast of the Mormon story when it comes to the way he led and dealt with things.
And yet it sets up so much to follow.
It does.
Yeah.
In a very unexpected way, I think.
Right. If he had been killed in Missouri or in Kirtland, right, in those couple of instances,
right,
Mormonism would be a completely different thing.
It wouldn't be the beast that it is now, I don't think.
I mean, they had to go on such a journey to come back to a non-plural marriage situation, right?
Right.
So, yeah, that a lot of that journey would have been erased.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Ah.
Yeah, Nauvoo, strange times.
I mean, they did name it Nauvoo, so.
So let's get back to that mystery, though. Why do you think Joseph Smith did this with the plural marriage? I mean, he had so much to lose.
It seems like... It does feel like it's a very genuine belief. I feel like the you know, your first wife dies, you remarry, you then have two wives. I think he wanted to pull the divine. I think he wanted to try to reach. I think he wanted to build a bridge between the current plane and, you know, the next. I think he wanted to make it all the more heightened, the more spiritual. I think he wanted to raise the stakes spiritually, I think, is what it comes down to. Not, you know, he doesn't want to have all these wives necessarily for the sake of having a wife. He doesn't want to do it for the usual sex reasons or necessarily the whole power play of it, especially because he was trying so hard to hide it. I think it really was that he's trying to heighten the spiritual aspect of existence with what you can expect in the next life if you were to have had marriages where the spouse had previously died. If it can happen there, why can't I have them here? If that's the ultimate spiritual, let's bring that down. Let's bring it here.
I mean, it strikes me this is also like a Kierkegaardian time period. Like Kierkegaard himself is writing and thinking roughly at the same time. And I love Kierkegaard and all his thinking. And Kierkegaard makes the point, I mean, my favorite part of Kierkegaard is this idea of facing the absurd. No matter what God asks of you, you have to just do it.
Right.
And you get to, you know, you are blessed in this life here and now for taking that leap of faith. So I think the weirdness of plural marriage for Joseph Smith, in part, like, this is his test of faith. If he fully commits and never questions.
Exactly.
Because if he does question and he goes back, then sort of the whole house of cards falls apart.
Right.
The direct revelation, the fact that he's a prophet, I mean, all these sorts of things just crumble underneath of him. So he's all in.
Yeah.
Once he sees this and he believes it to be true, he has to go all the way.
Yeah.
And push it. So I think the more he pushes it, it makes it realer, makes it truer, makes God maybe more present for him. I'm not sure.
I think it's very much bridging that gap, that it's his test, and it's kind of the ultimate test for this group. Like, if you look at it, like, this was very much not for them.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt that was what was needed, that's what God was telling him to do. That's what was meant for him and meant for his people.
Yeah, maybe we've gotten inside his head a little bit here. It's still very strange.
It's very strange. It's the way he pushed for it, too, is what really gets me. It's just this unmoving push for it.
Yep.
And the need for it. Like he's grasping for it. It's not even like, oh, he's casual about it. No, like, it's almost desperate how much he wants to indoctrinate that practice.
And maybe move it past the point of secrecy.
Yeah.
The secrecy is sort of just like preserving the seed while it grows, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. It's fascinating. And Emma, of course, is opposed. That I don't know if we ever quite understand Emma's role in this well enough. I think I understand Emma Smith reasonably well now. Mm-hmm. Even Lucy Mack Smith to some extent. I mean, think about all of her sons dying right there in a row. Oof. She had one surviving son, I think, after all of these events. But Emma Smith, I really think, you know, she was so committed to her husband that this must have been a great betrayal and a great source of pain for her.
Oh, 100%.
Which resulted, I think, in her... Well, she did ultimately abandon this whole thing. She doesn't go to Utah.
Yeah.
But we'll get to her next time with Brigham.
Oh, Brigham.
Yeah, the conflict sort of persists.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, like we said, the tradition that he started carries on until Utah is annexed, speaking of which. Next episode is Utah. I'm just calling it Utah. I'm going to talk a hell of a lot about Utah. but we're mostly going to talk about Brigham Young and the Mormons' journey to Utah. I hope we're doing the work of trying to understand the Mormons to confront the weirdnesses, as Bri and I are doing right now, but not to either justify them or to use them to say, oh, the Mormons are weird and incomprehensible and therefore, you know, they're unworthy of attention or respect.
Yeah, the weirdness and the, I don't think I can call them nuances, but they are for him introducing these things.
Mm-hmm.
It sets the stage for what happens now, which we can condemn some of the things that happen now because it's been used as an excuse for misdeeds and for corrupting the whole of Utah, basically.
Up to the present day.
Yeah.
Fundamentalism, Mormon fundamentalism.
Yes,
right?
It's a disaster.
But it's certainly fundamentalism is weirdly defined here, right? Because we know in the history that if you really want to get back to fundamentals, there wasn't polygamy.
And it's not even that it's not Mormonism at its core that it's a problem. It's that they've created such a loop of themselves and given them themselves extreme power that the people in that loop are able to abuse that and get away with it outside of the scope of Mormonism, but they're using the LDS as the stepping stone to get away with doing these things and to do them.
My name is Dr. Rob C. Thompson. I hereby adjourn and declare close this meeting of the Secret Order of Alchemical Actors until such a time as we get together and do it again. I'm joined by Bri Litterall, our metallurgic prophet.
Bye, guys.
Thank you for the analysis today, Bri. Very insightful.
Always here for it.
Bringing that cult psychology to us. And next time, I want to call Confessions, Utah.
Utah.